You're tuned in to the Big Buck Theory. All right, guys. This week's episode, I sat down with a big buck killer. This guy has just, he's killed a lot of big bucks in the Northeast. He's killed a lot of big bucks all over the country, for that matter. If he finds a good spot and he knows, you know, he's confident in it, he'll sit there for 10 days in a row, dark to dark. That's pretty hard to do. I know I can't do those kind of, you know, those kind of sits back to back like that. And he knows a ton about deer. He's been studying them for a long time. So, yeah, I think this one's a really good one. I'm really excited to bring it to you guys. One thing about the episode is we lost power a few times during the episode due to the storm that was going on while we were recording. So there's a few breaks in the episode, but you'll hear it'll be just like a little spot, and then we jump right back into it. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys think about this one, this week's episode. Brett, enjoy. How's it going, Brett?
It's going.
How are you doing? I'm doing good. How are you spending your off season so far?
It's a good question. Not in the woods as much as I'd like to be spending it. Mm-hmm. I just been a pretty busy year, last year or two for me. We moved twice and had another baby and just a lot going on. So it's been pretty busy. My time outside has been more limited than it has been in the past, but I'm still getting out there. Just not as much as I'd like, but yeah, it's been filled with work stuff and family stuff and moving and getting houses situated and a bunch of stuff like that. But it's all good stuff. Just need to get through the busy period. So hopefully spend a little more time in the woods.
Yeah,
and I say that cautiously because I feel like I'm able to, even with that, to spend more time outside than a lot of people. So I'm not complaining, but right. Maybe just not as much as I'm used to.
Yeah, so, yeah. I hear you there. How many kids does that make for you now?
Four.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you got a whole busy.
Busy over here.
A whole gaggle of them now.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a balancing act with that for sure, even more so than it was before them. So
I bet you're gonna have some future hunters on your hands.
Yeah, I already, the oldest Colton is 7 and he shot a couple turkeys last year when he was 6. So he's already into it. I think they're and his younger brother Colton, who was 4 last year, is 5 now. He came along and he's interested in it too. But it's kind of baby steps with them and not trying to, you know, get them all into it all at once and just kind of pace it slow. And when they're ready and as they want it, I don't want to force it on them or anything like that. Or even put too much on their plate. Right. Both of them wanted to hunt the year before, but I just was like, yeah, you guys aren't quite ready yet, but you know, they're involved in the outdoors all the time. Doesn't mean I have to, you know, pull the trigger to be involved in the hunt and, you know, the experience. So, but yeah, they're already kind of hunters or starting to be, so it's pretty cool.
That's cool, man. And most of the listeners probably know who you are, but if they don't, do you want to give a little bit of a background on yourself, what you do for work, style hunting you like to do?
Sure.
You know,
sure. That's where I grew up, really.
Hey, Brett.
Yep.
You want to restart that? You cut out right as you started.
Sure.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm from New Hampshire. This is where I grew up. I lived in New York for a few years during college, but other than that, I've lived here my whole life. I help run a family-owned sheet metal fab shop. That's kind of my day job. Also do some real estate stuff on the side, and then where people may know me from or may be interested in this from Just Hunt Club, and we create a lot of content on YouTube, based out of the Northeast for the most part. But you know, we have hunts and experiences that we film all over the North America, really. So we've been doing that for several years. I think I had a little bit of a different start in the hunting world because nobody in my family hunted, so I kind of gone into it on my own, which kind of shaped, I guess, my style of hunting and how I kind of see hunting in the hunting world. I guess it's just a little bit different because I didn't have anybody kind of guiding me in a particular direction. I didn't have any real influences, you know, like personal influences. Obviously I read magazines and, you know, watched hunting videos and stuff. And that, those are definitely influencers on the direction of my, my hunting world. But I didn't have like a, you know, a deer camp to go to. I didn't have a dad that took me hunting. My dad was involved in the outdoors, big into fly fishing, and we used to actually race sled dogs. So I've always been involved in the outdoors, but not just on the hunting side. So I think it gave me a little bit of a unique start and perspective, and it kind of allowed me to go in a direction that was, you know, uniquely my own, rather than kind of start off in somewhere where like your dad and older brother, you know, guided you. And I honestly kind of wish that I had that other experience too. I think there's a lot of value in that. And I'm seeing, you know, as my boys get into hunting, how important and how well, you know, hunting and family merge together, but I just didn't have that growing up. So I have a little bit of a different unique perspective on that, I think. You know, I've been hunting for a while now. I'm 37 and I've been hunting since I was probably 12. So it's not like I'm new to it, but I just didn't have the same, you know, start that a lot of guys did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that I think that makes for an interesting, you know, perspective when you don't come from a heavy hunting background, culture, whatever you want to call it. But one thing I wanted to ask you before we got any deeper into this was, did you play sports when you were in high school? Were you like athletic?
Yeah, I played baseball mainly. I did play basketball and wrestled and ran track when I was a little bit younger, but mainly I played baseball in high school. And then I got a scholarship to play Division I baseball. Mm-hmm. And I actually got injured pretty bad my freshman year of college. So that pretty quickly derailed my my baseball career.
Yep.
But yes, I did. I was played competitively, and it was pretty much my life from when I was, I don't know, 10 to 21 or 22.
No kidding.
So yes.
Yeah. It seems to be a trend that I've noticed over the years is the guys that are like really serious into deer hunting. A lot of them come from a athletic background, you know, and when the sports stop, they need something to put in the place.
That's exactly right. I mean, I remember the day that transition happened. It was my junior year in college, and it was May. And I actually, after I got injured, I transferred from to Southern New Hampshire University, a Division II school, because I just couldn't compete at the Division I level with the injury I had. And I remember we were taking infield, outfield. We were playing Franklin Pierce, and I threw in a ball during infield, outfield, and I had a shoulder injury, and I had rehabbed it. And I was reluctant to get surgery because I had watched three or four other guys on the previous program I played for get the same surgery and then re-tear. I had a torn labrum and re-tear it and then have to go through the same thing again. And it's like a 6 to 8 back then. I don't know, maybe it's accelerated now, but it's like, it was at the time, it was like a 6 to 8 month recovery in a sling. And that would have drove me crazy. And I was like, maybe if I have to do that once and it's like, you know, 90% success rate on the, you know, on the surgery, I'd be okay with it. But I watched a buddy do it literally 3 times. And I'm like, I'm not spending 3 years in a freaking sling. Like, I'm good. Like, so I rehabbed it and it limited me and I was okay with that. And I never got it fixed actually. And it's fine today for, I mean, pretty much anything, luckily. But, you know, obviously I've been throwing a baseball, but, yeah, I threw that ball in and something happened to my shoulder again. And I was just like, well, I think that's a wrap. I don't think I can do this anymore. And I remember like the next day I was like, I think I was late to practice or, you know, one of the next practice because I went turkey hunting and it was like, my mind had already, I had already shifted. And like, you know, when you're in a college baseball program, you don't like aren't late to practice because you go hunting, right? That's like a, that's not a, a real thing. So I decided after that, and it was towards the end of the year anyway, but I decided after that, I'm like, yeah, I'm not in it. And like I used to be, it's just, if I can't be in it 100%, I don't want to do it. And I kind of just shifted and I went pretty crazy on hunting right after that. So it was a dramatic shift and it was in an instant, but yeah, that's exactly kind of my, I guess, situation is baseball ended and hunting started. And I'm happy that I had that because I don't know what I would have done, you know, if I didn't have something else to dive into and kind of become obsessed with, to be honest. So,
yeah, it seems like a lot of the guys that I talk to, they all kind of have that trait, whereas they like really need to have something that they can put, you know, all their energy into and obsess over and work at. And, you know, so I think it's, you know, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of these guys were big into sports when they were younger.
Yeah. I am so happy and grateful about, you know, before my upbringing and my experiences growing up, developing, you know, as a young man in sports, because it taught me so much about hard work and discipline and in life in general and how to, you know, succeed, but also fail. And then how to deal with that. And luckily I had those skills because when you're deer hunting, you fail a lot, right? Especially when you're chasing big deer.
Oh yeah.
it's, you know, you may get lucky once or twice a season on a good year. So, you know, I was like, okay, you know, in baseball, if you hit, you know, 300, that means you're successful at the plate 3 out of 10 times. And so people struggle with that. And it's like, man, that if I could be successful 3 out of every 10 times I went hunting, that would be out of this world. So yeah. I was okay. I learned how to deal with that. So I think that's right though. And I think, you know, to be a super successful hunter, you need to have that, because especially in this region of the country, because, it's so difficult. And if you don't have that, you'll experience some success if you stick with it, but you're just never going to get to a, you know, level. And I don't know that, you know, some people probably don't care if they ever get to that particular level, but you know, for guys that are, I guess, competitive and driven and want to excel at any particular endeavor that they're involved in, you know, it does take a lot. So that makes sense.
So I like stats, and you being a baseball guy, I'm sure you like stats too.
I do like stats.
How about you talk a little bit of some stats on some bucks you've killed? I'd like to hear them.
I mean, where do you want me to start? Like, what do you
get? How about how many northeastern bucks have you killed that score over 120 inches?
Okay. I don't have that stat off my head, but I am with all my deer. So give me like 5-10 seconds and I'll count what I can right now.
Yep.
It's
always a good sign when you got to count.
7, 8, 9, I think 10. That's over. Good. You said 120?
Yeah.
Yeah. About 10.
10 bucks in the Northeast over 120.
Maybe 9, actually. I'm looking at one here.
9.
I was 9, I'd say, yeah. I was thinking of mature bucks. So I've probably killed 10 mature bucks. I have killed 10 mature bucks, but yeah, 9 of them have been over 120.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's pretty, that's a good high number. Now, would you say your primary way of hunting would be stand hunting?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that is how my whole strategy and focus revolves around. But you know, that's not the only thing I do.
Yep.
Although most of the time I do feel like my best opportunity to be successful, my highest odds are out of a tree stand, or a blind or whatever, but that doesn't mean that that's always the case. And I am definitely not afraid to still hunt or track, or even I killed one on a little tiny little push where I knew a buck was bedded in. This particular area, and I had a buddy, I was having a rough year and I knew he was in there, and I knew where he was going to go out the backside, and I had him push him out to me. So I've done that too. So yeah, stand hunting is the main objective, but I mean, that's like the plan, because I feel like the rest of it is a challenge to plan, because it's all kind of situation and weather dependent. Mm-hmm. So I plan to stand hunt and then, you know, go from there really. But most of the time I do end up in a stand. I'd say probably 80 to 90% of the time I'm hunting at it, I'm in a tree stand. Cool. Or some stand location. Yeah.
Right. And I'm excited to talk to you about that, because, you know, I've had trackers on, I've had the bow hunters on. Well, I haven't had anybody on that was like primarily a sitter. And, you know, I've killed bucks sitting. I killed one in Vermont this year sitting. You know, I'm not afraid to do it, but I think it's overlooked at how difficult it is on the mental side of things. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you approach, how you approach doing what you do with the, you know, the mentality you have to bring to it?
Yeah. So, you know, to get where I guess I am mentally, as a, we'll call it a stand hunter or a sitter. Mm-hmm. It was definitely an evolution. I didn't start out being able to sit in a stand for, you know, Sunday straight dark to dark to kill a buck. I think that my biggest obstacle though, when I couldn't do that, or I don't know if I could, it seems almost to a lot of people like unbearable or unimaginable that someone could do that or that they could do that. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like that to me. I remember when I was started hunting, I would like struggle to sit till 9 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Like struggle. Like I was like, you know, 8:45, that's close enough to nine. I'm getting down. Like I want to go see what's over the ridge. I want to scout. Like I can't sit here. So I can definitely relate to the guys that are, you know, in that situation or have that feeling. I think the biggest thing for me is when I started to felt like I had an idea of what I was doing, I guess, and gained more confidence in what I was doing and then had some success, that just kind of snowballed. And I kind of was able to identify areas that were worth my time, identify situations that were worth my time sitting. And like, I don't hunt. And that's the other thing, I guess, to touch upon. I don't hunt that much, honestly, like A, because I don't have the time, and B, because like, I only hunt when I think my odds are high to kill. So I learned to identify those, you know, periods and scenarios where I felt like my odds were high and focused on them. And so it, you know, I don't sit for, you know, five straight days in October. You know, if I'm hunting in October, if I hunt for three straight days, that's probably a long stretch. And those probably aren't dark to dark sits. So, I'm not spending that much time in the tree other than during November, and particularly the second week of November through like the end of the month. And the reason I'm able to do that is twofold, because I believe that, well, I have data and I have personal experience that tells me that's the time to be in one spot. Because if you're after a big deer and you're in a good spot to intercept him, there's a very high odds that he's probably going to come through there if you put your time in. I remember for years and years and years, I'd track or still hunt or just scout. And I remember I'd come across places and I'd be like, man, I bet if you sat here for a week, you'd kill that deer. Like he has to come through. And I kept saying that. And finally I was like, why don't I just sit there for a week then and kill him? And I started to do it and it started to work. So, you know, it's been a progression. I think the other thing is hunting out of state, which I've done a lot of, and experiencing different areas of the country and seeing deer do things that, you know, deer do. And we think that they do here, but there's so little of them and there's so little observation that I feel like a lot of people have doubts in their strategy and that the deer is actually going to do what they're supposed to, because I've just never seen it there are so little deer. But, you know, hunting in different places and seeing deer interact with, you know, topography and edges and landscape and during different times of the year, you know, scraping and chasing does and cruising, I really kind of learned about deer behavior. And, you know, our deer, although the behavior is slightly different here than in the Midwest, the landscape is way different and the density is way different, but the behavior is similar. Obviously because of the landscape and the habitat's different, they interact slightly different, but I was, you know, seeing things and confirming things that I thought and then applying them, you know, to New Hampshire, which is the main state that I hunt in the Northeast. And then, you know, seeing that, oh no, these things are still happening here. They just, you just have to, you know, identify them. And they're harder to identify and they happen less frequently, but they do happen, and you can have a pretty effective hunting method hunting from a stand, you know, if you put the time in. And I think the number one thing is you have to believe in it. Mm. You have to believe you're going to be successful, and you have to be ultra confident, or else I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can sit there for day after day. I know I can't. Like, if I had a spot where that's kind of going back to my original point. If I'm not really confident, I just don't sit. Mm-hmm. And I'll scout, or I'll still hunt and scout, or, you know, if there's snow, I'll track. But, you know, you have to be confident in it. And there's a process to almost convince yourself that it's going to happen and to make yourself confident. You can't just say, I'm going to be confident because I want to be. That's not how it really works. Like, you can't, I'm not able to trick my mind. So I have to have like data and evidence and, you know, examples and, you know, and to be frank, I have to be after a buck that's worth a week of my time to me. So, and that's a big part of it as well. So if I can put all those things together, I can be confident enough to do it. And it still isn't easy, but I will say that, the longer you sit, I gain more confidence because I feel like I'm getting closer and closer to the, you know, the point where that deer is going to come through. Mm-hmm. If the setup's right and I'm not, you know, he's alive and all, you know, there's other factors, but if everything's as it should be, I kind of gain confidence as it goes, and it actually gets easier and easier for me as the days go on. The first couple of days are the most difficult. Mm. But if you can get through there, you kind of get in a groove, and, you know, I almost sometimes feel like I just keep sitting there. You get a little loopy and crazy, but you know, you can do it. It's like anything, you know, you just adjust, yep. Your body adjusts, you're mentally, you adjust, and you're like, this is what I'm doing. And you know, that's that. And so I think that's the biggest challenge for guys in the Northeast that want to be successful or want to try to be successful stand hunting is just that discipline to sit there and not say, oh, I wonder if that spot's better. I don't know if he's going to come by. You'd be like, no, I'm in the spot. Mm-hmm. I know I am, or at least a spot that's as good as any other. And I know this deer is here, or he was, you know, very recently. He's in the area and he's going to come through here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to have that. And then the other thing is during that hunt, you have to stay. I think you have to eat good food. You have to be hydrated and you have to get sleep. Mm-hmm. Because you have to stay warm too. You have to have warm clothing. Cause if you get cold, you get tired, you get hungry. You start to get negative and you start to doubt mm-hmm. what's going on. And that's another thing that even if you have the best spot can kill that plan, if you're, you know, physically and mentally not taking care of yourself. So when mm-hmm. I do those hunts, when I sit for a week plus, I'm, you know, making sure I'm drinking plenty of water, I'm getting plenty of sleep. And, you know, I have good clothing to keep me warm because that's an important thing as well.
You got to stay positive, right?
Absolutely. You got to believe in it. You really do. And it's not like for no reason, just saying that. You actually have to have, like I said, or at least me, I have to have information and a reason to believe it.
Well, I think
I'm a pretty analytical thinker. So, and like you said, data driven, absolutely driven by stats and data. So, if I don't have that stuff to back it up, it's pretty difficult for me to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's human nature. If you start to get like cold or hungry or down on yourself and you're getting a little, you know, I don't know if this is a bad word, but like getting a little depressed, you know, you're kind of like, man, I should go somewhere else. This spot sucks, you know, but if you can keep yourself mentally in the game, if you can keep yourself, you know, comfortable, that's going to, you know, further your odds to actually staying there for, you know, 6 days in a row or whatever it takes. And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you about sitting and stuff is because some years, man, we just, you know, I like to track, but some years we just do not get good weather for tracking. And it's like the amount of miles that I've put on, in the mountains, like, I know where to sit. I know where bucks go through. So it's like, you know, if you got those warm, dry years, hey, the bucks are still moving through those mountains looking for mm-hmm. does. They're still pushing does around. It's just, you know, you could tromp around the mountains all season long on dry ground and maybe you'll grunt one in, but maybe not. Maybe you're just going to blow deer around, right. You know? So I do think,
and that's,
yeah,
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And that's kind of why I've developed that, you know, style that I have, because it doesn't matter if you have snow. It doesn't matter if it's rainy. It doesn't matter if it's windy. You know, during a certain, you know, period in November, those deer are going to be moving. Even if it's warm, honestly, they still will do it. I do think that it's probably better if it's the weather's colder, but I know that they still do it when it's warm.
Oh, they do, yeah.
And I know that, yeah, and I know that unless I have tracking snow or I have zero knowledge of the area and I'm like going in with I don't know anything about it, and I'm going to still hunt and scout, like, my best odds are sitting for sure. I do think that if you have good tracking conditions, that's probably the highest odds for any given day to kill a mature deer. I don't think that's really arguable if you have any sort of experience tracking. Like if you have good tracking snow, that particular day, your odds are probably higher than any other point, you know, in the season, from, you know, opening day archery to the end of the year to kill a mature buck. But other than that, I've just felt that, you know, if I have the right situation, sitting is my highest odds, regardless of kind of the weather or the situation. I think an important thing though is, once again, identifying that the deer you want, or the, you know, multiple deer or whatever in the area, you know, having some sort of an idea historically what deer that deer or, you know, other bucks have done during that time period, and then being there and finding the spot that you can sit, you know, day after day. And, you know, so there's a fair amount that goes into that too, but, that's important too. So it's not just a, you know, stumble in the woods and sit there and like hope it happens. It's not that, you know, it's a lot of planning. And I like to prepare for things. That's just how I am. I like to, you know, I like to look at maps and I like to scout and I like to run trail cameras and I like to look at dates and get my gear good to go. And so I like that preparation. That suits my personality and my style. So, you know, I'm, you know, almost year round preparing for that period of the year, and to, you know, to be able to put myself in that spot where I can do that. Obviously I hunt other times of the year. I bow hunt, you know, right from early September through, you know, the end of the season in New Hampshire during bow season. And I've had some success during that period as well. But that's more of a situational, you know, year by year, deer by deer, deal, where like, I don't, you know, I couldn't tell you where I'll be, and I have an idea, but where I'll be this September, right? It's kind of like, you kind of have to make those decisions like right, like on the fly, because the deer are, so pocketed and so, they're pocketed in there. They almost change what they're doing. I feel like every 3 to 4 days, like they're in an area, they're on a food source and they move and they're on this, you know, or they're just wandering around. So, you kind of have to strike. And that's why I say outside of that rut, I'm probably only hunting for 2 or 3 days at a time to try to capitalize on a window of high odds. And then I'm probably backing out for a week or two or however long. So,
So when you're, like, let's bring it all the way back to the beginning, and let's say you're going to go hunt a mountain for the first time, and you're starting on, Onyx or Hunt Stand or whatever you use. I don't know what you use, but when you're starting there, when you're starting there, where or what are you looking for? Like what kind of features are you looking for on the map to find a place to sit? Or, and I just want to throw this in real quick. Do you know in the Adirondacks, they call places they sit, they call it a watch?
I haven't heard that.
Yeah. So the guys, the guys over in the Adirondacks, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's a good watch up there.
I have not heard that.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Yeah. So anyways, so go.
Of course, it depends on where you're at. I it's funny because you hear like mountain hunting and big woods hunting, and a lot of it's, I think, well, maybe it's just the content I consume or see, but it seems like a lot of it's focused in the Northeast. But, you know, the quote unquote mountains of, you know, like Southern Ohio or West Virginia, or, you know, Pennsylvania or, you know, Western New York, whatever, are a lot different than the Adirondacks, which are a lot different than Maine, and which are a lot different than some of like the Southern New England stuff too. So it really depends on, you know, you have to know your setting. And I'm really, I'm always ultra focused on that because I think there's a lot of similarities, but there's like little subtle differences, sometimes not so subtle, but there's differences. So it kind of depends where I'm at. So I think the first thing is try to identify the landscape that you're in, try to identify the elevation, the forest type, the food sources, the deer density, like all those things are super important. They're going to start to, you know, shape my approach to what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I want to know those things. And once I do that, I think the biggest generalization I can say is I'm looking for topography, mm-hmm. Usually pretty dramatic topography. And I'm looking for kind of converging habitat types. And that can be a multitude of different habitat types, depending on where you're at. But usually it involves a cut and a hard wood, soft wood line, I'll say. That's mm-hmm. kind of the or a swamp. So those are the areas I'm looking for. They're pretty easily identifiable with, you know, our mapping apps we have today and the technology. They're not super hard to find, at least if you have an idea of kind of what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. But when I find those areas, I'm going to pin them and then I'm going to basically put boots on the ground and speed scout them. And I don't know if I'll say I have a knack for it. I feel like I'm efficient. You know, I don't sound like a competition. I compare myself to others when it comes to this, but I think that I have the ability to look at a map, pick it apart and walk directly to where I think I need to be. Mm-hmm. Without ever being in the woods. And when I get there, I either know, yeah, this is the spot, or yeah, this isn't what I thought it was. So mm-hmm. I think that's a strength that I have, is being able to quickly pick apart a piece of mountain country or big woods and go in there to a particular spot and either identify sign and confirm what I thought, or learn that, hey, this isn't quite what I thought it was. And oftentimes I found those, went into a spot like that, found it and said, man, this looks like the spot. And I realized after 3 or 4 years, yeah, no, that was a spot. That was the best area to be, you know, at that given time in that piece of woods, you know, because you learn that, oh, there's a good deer in here and he's using this area, but is there a better spot to kill him? Is there a better area to, you know, find him? Or, you know, is he spending more time in another area? And oftentimes the original, you know, area or spot or X that I had identified is the spot. So mm-hmm. that is an efficiency thing that I think I've just learned and picked up over the years, just, you know, through experience mainly. I mean, it's tough to teach that type of stuff. You just have to spend time in the woods and you know, think about what you're doing. But I'm big on identifying the regional, or like even, I guess, the regional differences between habitat types, deer and all mm-hmm. that stuff. Yeah, that's kind of how I approach it. And then I'm going to go from there, really. But yeah, I think so, like, you know, saddles are great ones. But of course it depends. I mean, sometimes saddles, I've been in saddles that are like up in mountain goat country where like, I mean, it's like a knife edge on the top and it's like damn near 45 degrees to get, you know, maybe even more than that, to get up to that saddle. And I just don't see deer. Not that they don't go up over it, I'm sure that they do, but I don't see it being like a highway. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's that deer are using when they're going A to B, cruising and trying to cover ground. So it really depends. And sometimes you can tell that from, you know, topo lines, and sometimes you can't until you're there. Sometimes you struggle to realize how steep things are, how big they are. Sometimes you think saddles are, you know, maybe the topo lines lead you to believe they're 80 yards wide at the top. But then you get there and they're 300 and it's not really concentrating deer movement as much as you'd hoped. You know, mm. you don't find the little micro X spot in there. So it's, you can get, you know, a long ways by aerial stuff, but you really need to go in there and, you know, boots on the ground and quickly. I am always going quick. And I wish that it wasn't like this, but I always feel like I'm rushed in the woods. until I'm sitting, of course. Maybe that's why I like to sit, because I don't feel like I'm rushed.
Right.
There's nothing to rush to. But yeah, so I'm all about, you know, covering ground, going. And, you know, I've walked across a lot of stuff that maybe walked past deer, walked past areas that had deer, for the sake of efficiency. And I just feel like, yeah, I could take more time and look at things more thoroughly. But if I keep going to those high odds where everything comes together, where it looks right, and I hit enough of those, you know, a lot of them are going to be hits, and that's, you know, what I need, rather than going to one area and just like picking it apart and learning every little thing about it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
No,
that, I do that usually after the fact, like year two or three is, you know, of, okay, this is a good area. There's a couple really good deer in here. You know, I have a really good idea of what's going on, but I'm going to really break this down. And I did some of that, you know, this past season too, or I said this past season, this during this off season in a couple spots that I'd hunted for a few years, but I'm like, okay, I know there's a good deer in here. I know he survived and I'm going to really focus on them this year. So I'm going to break it down even more. And I did uncover a few things that may be, you know, useful going into the season. So that's kind of my approach.
Now, one thing I wanted to hit on real quick is, now, have you ever noticed that when you like hunt an area for a couple years, you have to kind of change it up because the deer kind of catch on to you? Have you ever noticed that?
That's a good question. Let me think. I've never thought about that. So with the way that I hunt, I would say no.
Okay.
And that's because, like I said, I think those deer are very tolerant of intrusion during the rut. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's the deer being tolerant of it or it's more that they just are moving so much that, you know, say that they're living in a, on a mountaintop that's 100 acres and there's a 50 acre cut up there and 50 acres of softwood and they're bouncing back in there and he's hanging there a lot of times in say early October, you know, he has a huge range, but he's maybe there for a couple weeks. He's in there pretty heavy. Well, if you go and hunt that deer in that 100 acres and he's in there a lot of the time for 7 straight days, the impact on that particular deer in that area is dramatic. But if you hunt that same area when that deer is there, you know, once a week and he's on the next 3 mountains and he's coming through there, well, all the time when he's not there, you're not really affecting how he interacts with that area. Mm-hmm. So I don't think during the rut, I'm not saying you can't overpressure or be in there too much, but I think that it's a lot harder to do that. And also the way that I hunt, I'm always trying to blow my wind in a safe direction and I'm trying to, you know, access and leave stands in a way that I'm not running into that deer if I can help it. Of course, you know, in timber country, you never can be sure. They can come from anywhere, but I do my best. I'm playing the odds on that as well. And then early season, I'm really cautious not to do that. So I'm hunting the right winds. I'm very conscious of thermals and the same entry and exit. I'm tiptoeing in and then I'm trying to make, you know, a really calculated, like, you know, drone strike, if you will, like boom. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't happen, then I'm out of there. Like I'll hunt Tim 2 or 3 nights if I have a good wind or on a cold front, and then I'm out. So I would say no for my style. But I mean, I'm sure that can become a factor if you, you know, aren't hunting in, you know, a similar fashion where you're being cognizant of the impact you're having on the area. And it's hard because, you know, they could be anywhere and you don't always know where they're bedded or what, where is a safe place to blow your wind or, you know, it's a lot harder in, you know, mountain country, big woods, timber than it is in a lot of other places. The deer are less predictable. Mm.
Yeah. And I would say, the way I hunt a lot personally is I'm super aggressive. So a lot of times I tend to, you know, turn over every leaf, it seems like. And it seems like, you know, if I find an area that has big bucks in it, I have like 2 or 3 years to hunt it. And then I have to just pack up and head to another spot because I've just completely ruined it. I've seen that a bunch of times.
You know, half the time, no, and I feel like that is, it's almost like you over scout or over hunt because you're so into it.
Yeah. Over hunt it for sure.
I felt like there's, yeah. And but even on the scouting thing, like if you get the information you need to kill it, you think to kill a deer. Mm-hmm. And I've learned this because I've been obsessed with like particular, this usually happens to me on particular deer where I'm like after for multiple years. Mm-hmm. And so maybe now that I'm thinking more about your question, maybe that has been the case for me. It's tough for me to say exactly. But you know, I'm spent like, oh, he comes from over there. I got to learn every trail he uses. I want to see every rub he made, every scrape. I want to look at every potential bedding location. I want to locate every, you know, everything. And it's almost like, do I need to know all that? Not really. Like right. I'm kind of overcomplicating it and just like spending time in there walking around when I really am not gaining much. So I've been careful, and that's kind of what I'm saying with trying to go in and be efficient, get what I need, learn, be like, okay, yep, this is it. I don't really need to spend much time. I think the only caveat to that I'll say is that just because something was, you know, one way one year doesn't mean it's going to be the same the next year because things change.
That's great advice.
So I think it, and I'm very big on historical data and hunting based on like previous year's patterns, but there has to be some context to that. And you have to be, you know, aware of the situation and things may have changed. They may have cut a whole mountainside, or, you know, what's happened to me the last couple of years is there's been no mass crop, and that's really affected a lot of the deer's patterns. Whereas for years and years and years, we had a pretty good mass crop, and then we don't have it. And for 2 years, everything's been completely different. Mm. And I think when that, I've made the mistake of, you know, blindly believing in a plan that I had developed, you know, 11 months previously, and kind of ignored the, you know, real time information that I'm getting. So I think that's another thing I'm really working on, is trying to refine that and really use that up to date information, you know, to merge, to blend the plan with, you know, historical data and, you know, today's data. And I think that's probably the most effective way. And I think a great example is, as 2 years ago, I hunted a deer that I've been after for 4 years. And, I was seeing that he was kind of shifting out of a particular area. He was still coming through enough that I think I had would have had a pretty good opportunity at him. Mm-hmm. But there was that, and then there was no mast, which was, I think, keeping him in a particular area. And I just hunted that blind, and I really – and part of it was I didn't have – it was a tough fall for me, like, time-wise, and didn't have a ton of time to, like, scout. So I was like, this is what I'm doing, and it wasn't a successful, you know – successful deal for me. Last year I had a similar situation, but I decided to go with kind of a mix of both, and I had a good hunt. So I've kind of made that transition. I think that is really important. So you have to have a kind of a mix of both, I believe.
Yeah. You got to be able to get on that fresh sign. Definitely. And I am very excited to ask you about some historical data stuff, because I know you have noticed trends, I'm sure. And, real quick before we continue, if I cut out, it's because I lost power, because there is about 60 okay. mile. There's 60 mile an hour winds right now at my house. So
isn't that windy here yet, but all right.
Oh yeah, man. It is really brutal. So, if I cut out it, the podcast will save to where we're at and we'll have to pick back up.
Okay.
But, I just wanted to let you know that. So if I go dark, I'm not mad at you or anything. Okay. So can you tell me some things that you've noticed about big mature whitetails? I want dates. Do you have dates?
Yeah. Oh, I do have dates. Let me preface this by saying, I believe that all this is driven by does, and particular does, and particular doe groups. So these dates, I think, in a lot of areas, I think there's a generalization of dates, and then there's like really like hard dates in particular areas. And when I'm talking about those, I really believe that those are driven by particular doe groups and the timing of when they're coming in the estrus. And I think that in a lot of big wood settings, a lot of mountain settings, there's not many does being killed at all. Like, I mean, I don't know how many guys you know that climb 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet of elevation or go in 2 miles and kill a doe.
I don't know many. No. Most of the big woods, the does are just dying from natural causes, I would say.
So, I mean, there's plenty of information or data that shows that does can live up to 20 plus years, right? So you may have a doe that's hit sexual maturity at maybe, what, a year and a half, even 6 months old sometimes, but probably we'll say a year and a half. So you may have a 15-year period where a particular doe and her fawns in that doe group, maybe just her, it may be two does, whatever, are coming into heat within a day or two every year. For 15 straight years. So that's a very consistent, staple in a particular area. And I think that the bucks know that, and they know that doe. And, you know, that doe may be three times as old as the 5-year-old buck that's, you know, trying to breed her, but he's learned since he's been, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, that this is when, these does come in heat. So I think That is a very important thing that's overlooked. I also think that plays into genetics of an area as well. I've have that theory that a particular doe group influences buck genetics and antlers in particular is like in a big way. Mm-hmm. So that is an important caveat, but paying attention to particular dates in specific spots is really important, because I think that there's a general range of when, you know, things are.
We are back. Holy smokes. Yeah. Just had a big old gust come through and it went off. I'm glad I told you that before it happened.
you called it.
Yeah, I did. And hopefully it doesn't happen again, but if it does, hey, we'll have to just pick back up tomorrow night or Friday night or whatever works for you. But you were talking I believe you were saying you don't like the first week of November. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. Okay. I don't care for probably the first 10 days of November. And that's not to say they can't be good. Like, I've killed two really good, really good New Hampshire bucks on November 7th. So I'm not saying that it's not worth being out there. But if I'm going to take my time, it's going to be that, you know, third week. And if I had to pick, say, 5 days to hunt, and I could only hunt 5 days in 2024, it would probably be the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st. Those are the days I'd probably pick. And you could go a day or two on either side of that and still be in really good shape. But I have a lot of data to support November 19th as being about the best day to hunt of the year.
No kidding.
If you're trying to target a big buck. And that's through UNH University studies and on doe conception dates. And that's also based on a trail camera study that I did with a group of guys a few years back. And I think there was probably 4 or 5 guys that all ran a lot of cameras and were pretty serious about it. And we basically compiled our data, and I interpreted a bunch of different ways. But the bottom line was, we basically recorded every time we got a mature buck in daylight from, I think we did like October 25th. What did we do? Maybe October 20th. I'd have to look at the study. October 25th to maybe mid-December. And that daylight activity peaked for mature bucks on November 19th.
No
coincidentally,
kidding.
Peak doe conception too is on the same day. And I always thought that they wouldn't coincide, because I thought that the peak daylight activity for mature bucks would be before peak breeding. But I don't believe that to be the case in the Northeast, or at least in a big wood setting. So yeah, that was pretty eye opening for me. And after I kind of identified that, I've had nothing but stuff to confirm that that's spot on. And now that's kind of how, I plan my season. And so does, you know, some of the guys I hunt with, and it's been pretty solid, honestly, to bank on that. So obviously, like I said, you want to pay attention to those does and those individual situations, because those dates might not line up perfectly for the doe group in your area that's dictating, you know, the buck movement. But outside of that, those are the dates that I've found to be really, really bulletproof.
No kidding.
And it's almost shocking what you will see sitting, you know, a week in that time frame. It's like it turns into a different place. The amount of bucks moving in daylight and the opportunity that you'll have. It's kind of it was a big eye opener for me.
No kidding. Yeah. Cause I wonder, you know, I bet you that's like those dates are probably the best throughout the majority of the northern states in the country, I would bet.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'll say. I've hunted a lot of northern states. I don't have the data and experience that I do in New Hampshire and those other states. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to claim to say, oh, those are the best there too. I suspect that they may be, mm-hmm. but, you know, I do think that particularly say, like, you know, Iowa is a northern state for the most part. And so is, you know, well, we'll say Iowa because I've hunted it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it could be Minnesota, it could be Wisconsin, it could be Montana, whatever. I do think that from my experience, what I've seen, it seems like that earlier period before the peak breeding is better there. Mm. And it may just be a habitat, landscape, and buck to doe ratio difference that creates a different, you know, period. And I don't know if it is different, to be honest. I don't have enough experience. It's secondhand stuff. I've only hunted Iowa during the rut for 3 days, honestly, or four. Yeah. 3 days, 2 days maybe. So I don't know. But yeah, you may be right. It's tough for me to say. I know I feel pretty confident in those dates for like Maine, New Hampshire. I won't say Vermont because I haven't spent a ton of time in the deer woods in Vermont, but I believe it's the same in the Adirondacks, which is kind of on the other side of Vermont. So I have to imagine that
right. It's
similar. And, you know, I've had some experience in PA and it seems to be pretty solid there. Although, you know, there I feel like earlier could be better too. So it's not, it seems like you have to, for that to be in effect, you want to be in a northern latitude, big woods and relatively low deer densities. That's what it seems to be the formula to make those dates really work. And I'll say that in Canada where I hunt, it's almost the same, exactly the same as well.
No kidding.
So yeah.
So interesting.
Which really bothers me because I want to be both places at once.
Yeah.
I wish that I had four third weeks in November every year. I'd be really happy because I could, you know, hunt the best of the best in three or four different states. But, you know, it's I have to pick one, unfortunately.
Oh, buddy, you got to get cloned.
Yeah. Do something. It's funny. I'm always like searching for an area that has a, you know, like, oh, the first week's the best there, you know, cause that would be really helpful. Well, great. I can hit the peak of, you know, the rut in two different areas and not, you know, have to be in three places at once, which is, as far as I know, impossible.
Yeah, it is. So interestingly enough, out of all the cameras that I've run for, you know, the last 10 plus years, the number one day I've had for mature buck daylight pictures has been November 4th.
Really?
Yep. And that's just been my findings. Like I know it,
yeah.
You know, and it doesn't always match up, you know, it never really seems to match up with other people's findings. It might just be my style. Well, you know what I mean? Like where I put them.
Well, that's, right. And it could just be, like I said, the does. I don't know if this is over a huge area, maybe because that kind of goes out the window if you're talking about, you know, multiple states and multiple pieces of woods. But yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I try to disprove that in different areas and
yep.
like try to find a pocket where it's better. And I just haven't been able to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's really frustrating because, like I said, I want to hunt. This peak period in two different places or two different places one November, but I haven't been able to find it yet. So, yeah, but you know, those, I would, you know, if you want to tell me where that is and on November 4th, I'll go sit there. That would be,
I would say
that would be great.
But
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Who knows? I mean, you could be in an area where it's better than, and I've talked to some buddies in Maine in a particular area. And they feel like that is a good, that first week in November, late October mm-hmm. is awesome too.
I've noticed, I'll just throw out some dates here that I've noticed throughout the years that I've had pictures of mature bucks, daylight. And these are just days, you know. All right, we're rolling again. Wow.
All right.
What a
day later.
Yeah. Day later. So, for the listeners, basically what happened was last night we were recording, and I lost power for a long time, so we had to pick back up following day, and here we are.
Hopefully, we can still flow like we were
yesterday. Yeah, yeah, we were going
it's
good.
It's kind of tough to go at it, but yeah, I think we were talking about some of the time periods that we saw and identified as being, you know, better than others and historically being good. Mm-hmm. And I think we were talking about, I think you had mentioned, you had some dates in September and October. And, I don't know that I have like particular days during that period, but I can tell you that from the opener of New Hampshire season, mm-hmm. which is September 15th to about through the first week to 10 days of October, I really like. I think that's a really good period for bow hunting, obviously.
Yep.
And I'm usually focused on food sources and scrapes in particular in those food sources. I'm almost always hunting scrapes, actually.
Really?
I'd say probably 80 to 90% of my stands are like on scrapes. Mm-hmm. And that scrape may relate to a food source or a bedding area or, you know, like a rut funnel or whatever. But yeah, it seems like scrapes, particularly for bow hunting, are super valuable to have that deer, you know, coming into that close range and a predictable spot. And I don't always do that, but I think if you have a scrape in the area, and it's, sometimes I make mock scrapes that have been super productive as well. So it doesn't have to be a real one. But yeah, that period I like there. I said before, I don't care for mid to late October and then even the first few days of November. I'm not saying that's, you know, it can't be good. And I've had some good flurries there on cold fronts or, you know, certain situations. But
right.
Historically, that seems to be, yeah, the period that I struggle from, like, we'll say October 10th through first week in November.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you got to be close to them that time of year for sure.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Now,
and even then, I feel like there's no, like, you know, late October and early November, definitely you can catch them on a scrape, like, you know, first and last light. Mm-hmm. If you're close. But I feel like even mid October, even if you are close to them, it seems like sometimes they don't even, like, so I was hunting a buck a few years back, and this was still in the first week in October, but I was really confident that I knew where he was bedding within a couple hundred yards. And I know that on one particular day, I knew where he got up from, and I was hunting probably 250 to 300 yards from where he was bedding. Mm-hmm. And I had a camera between me and him, essentially, where he was bedding. And he hit a scrape, probably an hour before dark. And I was like 170 yards from that scrape, and I was in the direction that he was headed. Mm-hmm. So he was coming towards me, and it took him like 2 hours to move 150 yards. Like he actually came by the stand after I climbed down, about 15 minutes after shooting light. I got a picture of him on the scrape that I was actually hunting. So it took him that long to move that far. And I think that's the biggest thing that, you know, you have to realize is you could be within 100 yards or 150, but he could get up and just spend 45 minutes speeding in a tight circle. You know, they're not, just not moving very quickly. So yeah, you've got to be really tight sometimes. And I think in the mountains, it's like hard to gauge, like, how tight do you get? And then, you know, a lot of times you're not hunting a specific bed. You're hunting like an area that you're bedding. So like, do you hunt the edge of that? Do you push in the middle of it? Like, you don't know. Like, so it's really mm-hmm. tough. I feel like to calibrate bow hunting early season, where to get in on them. So you can either hunt them a lot and hunt them conservatively, or you can get really aggressive, and kind of go for broke. So, I mean, I don't know. I try to do my best to do a combination of both, you know, mm-hmm. hunt 2 or 3 days at a time on good winds and good weather and hope for the best. But, it's really hard, really, really hard, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It is hard. Now, have you noticed that towards the end of November, do those bucks, are they still kicking out those scrapes and working the licking branch, or are they just going through the area, kind of like walking through it?
That's a really good question. I think that this November, I saw more bucks during the like third and fourth week of November working, like actively working scrapes, like working licking branches, kicking out. I don't usually see that. I think that that starts to die off as you get into mid-November. Mm-hmm. And I think they're cruising by him more than anything. But I say that, I was like really surprised at how much activity I saw on trail cameras of bucks this November. So I don't know. And I can't tell you why that would be, why this year would have been different. So if you had asked me, you know, a year ago, it would have been pretty like, oh yeah, they don't really work them as much, but you know, I'm always learning, and I've realized this year that may not always be the case. Mm-hmm. So I would say in general, it seems like they're really focused on working those scrapes. Like, well, I think they start, I mean, they use scrapes year round, really.
Yeah.
And obviously I think the activity, yeah. My opinion, I don't know what you've seen, but I think it peaks right around the first of November is like when scrapes are the hottest, I think. Mm-hmm. But but it seems like it starts to taper off. But man, I saw some great, I mean, noon, 11 o'clock, like, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, big, you know, 5, 6, 7 year old bucks working scrapes, like working them hard. This year, like on November, you know, I think one was the 18th, one was the 19th, the 22nd, like those dates. And then into like the fourth week of November as well. So, which I think is a really good week too. I like that last week. So I think that slows down a bit, but it's still better than like the first or the second week, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. No, I think, the reason why I brought that up is because I think if guys are like checking an area in that later time of November, sometimes those bucks will just, they'll just walk through the scrapes or they'll walk by them and it won't really look like they're active, but the bucks are still going 100%. Through. And
you know, and the one thing I've learned to do is I kind of start to ignore trail camera information after like pretty much like end of the second week of November. I'm like, okay, he was there, you know, on November 6th.
Yep.
I need to hunt. I just need to hunt. Like I'm not worried about if I got a picture of him. He's around, like he's going to come back through at some point. And sometimes they don't, but most right. of the time they're there. But I mean, it's, if you ever watch a buck, you know, moving during the rut, like, he isn't just like spending a lot of time. And if he doesn't walk right in front of that camera or work that scrape, you never know who's there. Because they're not really focused as much on working scrapes or leaving sign. It seems, like I said, this year I had some interesting stuff, but I don't think that was atypical. You know, so, but I don't know. Would you see, what do you think? What do you think that stuff peaks from what you've seen?
The scrapes I've seen.
Yeah.
September is right around the opener, I think, is really good. September 15th to the like 26th, like right around that time frame. Yeah. I think you can kill a big one on a scrape. And then towards like October 20th to November 10th, I would say is probably your best chance.
Yeah.
But then after that, I think, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot. I find a lot of them, especially like just sitting on the scrapes, like bucks will just, they'll just walk through them or they'll walk by them downwind of them.
Yep.
But yeah, that's what I've noticed.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one of the big things with scrapes, I think a lot of people overlook, is early season though.
That's
huge, I think they can be, well, I killed a really good buck last year, opening night on a scrape. And he was going to, I mean, there was oaks in the area.
Yeah.
He was in, but he was coming to that scrape. Like, he made a beeline for it and I shot him standing in it. And then, obviously not really big woods related, but I killed a buck, in South Dakota a couple of years back, also on opening day. That was September 1st though, but same thing, literally working a scrape when I shot him. So, if you can find like a scrape that's, you know, tight to where they're bedding or tight to a food source, man, that could be dynamite. And that's why I say I'm hunting over those things most of the year because of it. Not just, you know, not just during like, you know, the rut or late October. I'm literally hunting over those things pretty much every time. And if there's not a scrape in the spot, then I don't make one. I just think it, you know, increases your odds, whether they, you know, work it when you shoot them or whatnot. You know, who knows if they will, but it's not a bad thing to have it there.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll tell you what, it's a good thing they don't open the season on September 1st, because I would hammer, bucks that first week of September. They're so active on those things.
Yeah.
That time of year, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems, I agree. I mean, it seems like the earlier you can get, the better chance you have. Like, so September 15th, like that week's great.
Yeah.
Like, if, you know, that's a great week to kill a big buck. I think my favorite times are like the first week of the season and like the third week of November, if I had to pick 2 weeks, right? I would say that I've probably had more, well, it's probably pretty equal, honestly, the encounters that I've had. But if you do your scouting and you find the food source and you find the deer, and you play it right, you could be on a really good deer the first week, moving in daylight pretty habitually. I mean, it's not going to be, I mean, I have had some situations where they're doing the same thing every day, but it's super rare that you get that around here. If you're like, I can think of like maybe two or three instances where a deer is doing the same thing every day. But usually it's like he does it like a couple times a week, which in my opinion is really good. If you have a deer doing something twice a week or maybe three times a week in right. the early season, you can get on them. But it seems like the earlier that it opens, the better you're off. Like even if it opened September 7th, you'd be even better off on the 15th. And if you went to the 1st, you'd be even more so. I just think that they're like in these patterns, you know, that time of year. And they're mm-hmm. super relaxed. That's the other thing. Like, I don't know if you've seen it, but these deer just seem to be relaxed. And, yeah. you know, they're like on summer vacation still, you know, and they're not getting serious about anything. And they're kind of lax and mm-hmm. they don't seem too uptight about it. And the daylight activity can be really good.
Yeah, yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think they're definitely in their summer patterns, and their summer patterns, you know, they're very they're not on edge.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's I think it's probably because the testosterone levels haven't been spiked up, you know, maybe. I don't know.
I think it's more biological than like external hunting pressure related. I think it's just, like you said, something to do with, you know, the testosterone or the, you know, the kind of the mood or the point of the season. I mean, a September buck looks like a different animal compared to a November buck.
Oh, for sure.
And I've been fortunate enough to shoot a pile of September bucks, like early September through, you know, probably the first week or the third week in September. And, you know, it's a different animal mm-hmm. for sure. So you're hunting a more of a docile, relaxed, and they're still cautious, obviously, but they just seem to be, you know, more apt to get up and walk 200-300 yards in daylight. Mm-hmm. obviously during November there, it's a whole different deal, but, and I've seen it. And, you know, the interesting thing that I've seen too, is I usually try to get out of state and hunt early September, like for September 1st opener, is they have a weird period when they shed their velvet mm-hmm. where they almost disappear and become hard to hunt. And I've seen that a lot. And it doesn't matter if they lose their velvet on, you know, August 30th or September 12th. It seems like they have this weird period where they like go into hiding and you lose them for 3, 4, 5 days. Then they seem to come back right to where they were for a period, and then they probably shift. But mm-hmm. yeah, that's an interesting observation I've had over the, you know, past probably 10 or 15 years that I've really tried to hunt deer early in velvet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do some odd things, don't they? It's hard to nail them down.
Oh, it's impossible. That's why they're so fascinating. And I love, you know, learning about them and tracking them and just kind of studying them, because it's really interesting, I think, at least.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. It definitely is interesting. Now, have you noticed historical data from the same buck with like particular dates year to year?
Yeah, for sure I have. You know, I've heard people say that they can relate it back to like a particular day. Mm-hmm. There's been instances where I can, but here's the thing. I'm not the type of guy that sees a buck do something like, oh, this buck did something this year on November 3rd, he did it the next year, and then say that, oh, like you can count on if a deer does something on one day, he's going to do it the next. Mm-hmm. I've seen that, yes, but I can't say that it's like a super strong correlation that I've seen like day to day, you know, like year to year. It's more like a, you know, like in early November, he's in this area hitting this scrape, or like in the third week of November, he runs through this funnel checking these doe groups, like that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, early season, he's on this, you know, hardwood side of a mountain in mass crop. Like I've seen that more often, like, than I've seen like one day that he does the same thing. But I don't, you know, so, but I still think that that's still really relevant and really valuable to even know that a deer is doing something within like a week or two period, right? Like, mm-hmm. and you can predict it. So, so I don't know. Yeah. I'd say yes, but not like as, you know, defined and, focused as some people say that they see it. Mm-hmm. And like, I have seen that with some bucks, but it's not enough to make me think that it's a, like, you know, I can count on being there that same day.
Right. So, like a sure thing.
Yeah. Like I usually within like a period of maybe like a week. Yeah. I see that a lot. I do see it a lot, but to narrow it down to a day, I think it's tough in my opinion from what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. But I've definitely seen bucks do real crazy stuff right around the same time, you know, like daylight.
Is it,
you know?
Yeah. Do you usually see that like early season or during the rut or both?
Rut.
The rut. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tend to, like, it'll be not a homebody that'll show up the same within the same few days every year, you know, especially the old ones.
Yep. No, I think you're right. I think they learn and they just have like almost a routine.
Yep.
You know, when these bucks get 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, which they do in the mountains, you know, I think they start to fall into a routine. It seems like the older they get, the more habitual they get. But even that is, you know, can go out the window. Because I had a buck, I think I might have talked to him earlier, but that I had chased for 4 years. And I was like, well, I would have killed him in 21. I would have killed him, but I shot another buck before I saw him. He walked by like right after I killed the one buck, which is pretty wild. But I was pretty confident I was going to see that buck, and I did, but I didn't have a tag when he walked by. Mm-hmm. But I was like, "Oh, I'll kill him next year because this is wild." I had that buck's picture, I think, in 19 or 20, 30 different times in November.
Holy smokes.
30 different times. And I'm talking a big woods mountain setting. Like, and I had a lot of cameras, but not like 100.
Right.
You know, like, right. Like it was unbelievable how like regular and like active this deer was. It was, I mean, I couldn't believe it. And, he seemed to slowly shift away from that, you know, what he did though. And then to the point where 2 years ago, I should have killed him early, but I hunted him during the rut. I sat on him and I kind of like ignored the up-to-date data and was going on the historical stuff. And I didn't see him. And I think the last picture I ended up getting of him was like late, like maybe November 28th. And then I have not got another picture of that deer since. I didn't hear that he got killed. You know, maybe he died over the winter. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea what happened to him. And he was, I mean, I suspect he was 7 that year. And he was pushing 160.
Wow.
So it was a really big, big old deer. And then, you know, at 8, nothing. Completely, like, I looked for him. I was, you know, he was my focus for the season and never showed back up. So sometimes, and maybe he did die, I don't know, or got killed in December. Tough to say. I didn't hear about it if he did, but, doesn't mean it didn't happen, but you know, either that happened or he just shifted patterns, and they do that for no apparent reason sometimes. You know, you think you have the thing figured out and then it's like it just all gets turned upside down.
but
that's why it's so interesting, because if they're super predictable and you could figure it out easy, then you know, I don't think it'd be something that'd be interested in as much, you know, and wouldn't be as much of a challenge. They gotta leave you scratching your head sometimes, or else it's just not, you know, it's not the same.
Right. So. Yeah. It's just not the same. So I was wondering if you wanted to tell a few buck stories before we wrap this up, maybe like one or two of your favorites.
Sure. Let me think about, I'm trying to think of ones. The first one's a cool one, I guess. And the first one I say that's the first good one I killed. I'll tell that one quick. And it was really the one that changed. Honestly, it kind of changed my life, which is kind of corny to say, but it really kind of did. I've been, you know, hunting, as I talked about before, since I was young, you know, kind of on my own, or I had some guys that would take me out. But like I said, my family didn't hunt, so I was doing it mostly on my own, and I wasn't super successful, obviously. Like, imagine having no knowledge and no guidance and then trying to hunt, you know, New Hampshire. It's like, oof, that's not easy, right? So, you know, I killed a couple deer. With some help of people and a couple on my own. And then I got in the stage where I wanted to shoot deer. And I was excited about just shooting deer. And I remember I went to like New York and Maryland and shot deer. Like, I was like, oh, I see deer. This is awesome. This is great. Like, I was in that stage where I was really big on seeing and shooting things, which is fun. And it's a good stage. To be in, honestly, it's a fun stage, and it's good because it's exciting. And if you have any idea what you're doing, you have a fair amount of success, and it's fun. But then I kind of just, for a couple of years, I was like, man, I want to kill like a good deer, like a big buck. Mm-hmm. And I just wouldn't prioritize it. You know, like I just wouldn't pass, or I wouldn't, if I had an opportunity to go sit a spot where I knew there was a bunch here, I'd just go do that. Mm-hmm. And then finally I was like, all right. And I was 21. So it was 2007, I think. 2007, something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I think it was 2007. Anyway, I had a spot on this, like, it wasn't really mountains. It was more like ridgy stuff. Not like small woods, but I'd say like medium woods, if you will. Not like yep. suburbia, but not like big woods, mountain stuff. And I had this side hill. It was all oaks, and it was just a hot spot. It was always sign there, and it was close to where I grew up. So even before I was serious about hunting, I had like been out in this area a lot and like familiarized myself with it, and just kind of identified it as an area that always had deer and bucks in it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually literally where I killed my first deer, which was on my own, first buck. So I knew it was a good area. I knew that there was good bucks around. I just didn't really figure it out. And I just said, listen, I'm just going to stick to this spot and hunt it. And it was a spot you could hunt on a westerly winds consistently and get in and out clean. And I was like, I'm just going to continue to hunt this and sit on it. And I'm not going to shoot something small. I'm going to wait for a good deer. And so I sat that, and I don't remember exactly the year, but I know I couldn't really hunt mornings, but I could hunt in the evening. So I hunted it like every afternoon. Mm-hmm. For like almost a week. And I saw a handful of deer, and I passed like a couple small bucks. And then it was November 7th, right before dark. I remember I was sitting in my stand. It was muzzleloader season in New Hampshire. And I looked up, and I just see this big, you know, he wasn't like a white horn buck, but in low light, those beams look white, no matter if they're almost like different chocolate. They really like glow. Right.
Right.
And I just see this big beam coming, you know, running across side hill and at me. And I just like looked at that buck and was like, yep, that's it. That's what I've been looking for. And so I remember as he was going to hit my lane, I had looking straight down the ridge, and he got to 40, and I stopped him and hit him good. And he like, you know, reared up and ran like 10 yards and tipped over, and I watched him tip, and I was like, all right, like I did it. Awesome. And, you know, I was like super excited, and I was like, okay, like, whoa, like, you know, you almost don't believe it.
You're right.
And I was excited, but I didn't really understand like what a mature buck was, or like what I had done until I walked up on the deer. And I remember I walked up on him, and I just literally like stared at him for like 15 minutes and just didn't even do it. I just was like, wow, that's a different thing than I didn't realize. Like, and it was a really good buck. He was 200 pounds. I think it was like 140 inch 10.
Wow.
So it was and he was 7.5 years old. It was a really good deer, really, you know, stud, like a stud of a buck.
Yep.
And I just remember just staring at him, and like, it was like, and then it was like almost after 15 minutes, I was like, this is all I ever want to do is kill these, chase these things and kill these things. That was it. Like literally, like it was like my hunting did a 180, and this was actually, I know we talked earlier about like when a baseball, and it was right around that same time period too, mm-hmm. for baseball, I just ended. And I was like, okay, well that's it. Like, this is what I want to do. And like, that was it. And so that was a big one for me. And he's an awesome buck to this day. Like, still one of my, you know, I've killed some handful of bigger ones in New Hampshire, but he's one of the good ones for sure. And to have that success. And it was cool to make that conscious decision that I'm going to hunt for a good deer, mm-hmm. and put my time in and be disciplined and then have that success. And I think like all of that with the time in my life and everything, it kind of came together, and it just like set me down, you know, the path and in my hunting life that I'm on today for sure. So that was definitely a special one and an influential one on for me. But yeah, that one was awesome. I think another one, there's a couple, I guess we can go, if we have time, we'll go through a couple more, but
yeah, of course.
One of my favorite ones was, one that I killed and maybe, I think it was 16, and I had kind of scouted this new area in the mountains, and I was really high on it. I didn't, you know, you just don't know what's there, right? Like, it looks really good, and you think you, you know, you think you figured it out. And I'd found this really good saddle that I thought would be a killer spot. And, you know, I don't know, you don't know, but you think, right? And so I remember I hung a stand there in over like the winter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm probably going to hunt this next year. I don't know what's there, you know, what's going on. I'm like, I think this is a great spot. And so that next summer I started running some cameras and I had two really good bucks in that area. Two big eights, big old, you know, they looked like big old eights to me. I mean, really big eights. Mm-hmm. And, so I was kind of hunting the one, and then he kind of disappeared like earlier in the season. I sat on a couple times. It wasn't really serious. I didn't really know the area well enough to like really hone in on him. But then that, the one, the, almost, I'd say it's a bigger than two. The one was like, that I killed was like, I think he was 205 or something, 206. And he was like 151 inches. It's an 8-pointer. So a big deer.
Yeah.
It was like 5.5. But the other deer was probably pretty close to the same. And I think he actually was heavier. So probably he's one of the heaviest looking deer, big long deer that I've got pictures of. So I bet he was 220 plus. I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. Until you kill him, you don't really know. But he was a big deer. And he was pushing 150 as well. So I was hunting both these deer. And it seemed like the one that I didn't kill had shifted out, and then the one that I had over the summer shifted back into this area. And I was like basically getting his picture up on that saddle. Mm-hmm. And I was getting him about 700 yards away on this other little like top, the same mountain system, but a different top. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was getting him there on the edge of this cut coming out of, off this point of like spruce, like a spruce point that led out to this cut. Like, and so I had stands of both, and I was kind of like bouncing back and forth, trying to like hunt him here and hunt him there. And I get a picture of him there and kind of jumping around, like check the camera. And, oh shit, he was there, you know, doing that thing.
Yep.
And then finally I just, yeah. And I'm like, I don't think I can do this. I think I got to pick one of these spots and just sit it. Mm-hmm. So I made that decision and I was like, just missing him. And he was like, just almost cracking daylight. Like this is late October through the first week of November, this is happening. And finally I'm like, all right, I'm going to sit on that saddle that I planned on sitting. There was a big primary scrape on it that, you know, you could tell had been there for years and years and years, and it was a good spot. It was, mm-hmm. It was a son of a bitch to get into those, like, you know, 2 miles, and had to gain, you know, it was a challenge to get to.
Yeah.
And so it was like, this is the spot. And it was just a perfect textbook saddle. And like, it was awesome. It was probably only 40, 50 yards wide where it pinched down. So like, it was, you know, it was good. It was a really textbook spot in the mountains. So mm-hmm. I had sat it and I was sitting it. And, you know, I get that buck. I think I might've had a sell on one of those scrapes back then. Mm-hmm. So I think I was, I'm trying to remember. I think I did. And so I was like kind of going off, like, you know, I'd hunt and then that buck, I'd go back to the truck, and then like, I think I'd check the cell and like, he'd show up like after dark, like right on the other spot. And I was like, God, like, I don't know what to do. So finally I just stuck to the saddle. I hunted it for like 3 or 4 days straight. And I remember on November 7th, it was like, there was a super cold front. It was gonna be like a high in like the low 30s, and like the lows were in the 20s, you know, super high pressure. And he had been there, and I was like, this is going to be the day he's going to do it in daylight. I just had a feeling, right? Like, I was like, I got to be there. So went back in there for like the third or fourth day. And I wasn't sitting all day at that point. I was hunting evenings, cause that's when he was the most active, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. But that day I was like, I'm going to sit all day. It's like time to go after him and put the time in. Mm-hmm. And so I told you it was like a hard frost that morning. So I don't know if you've noticed, but like sometimes when you have the hard frost, the leaves are pretty loud in the morning, but it seems like when the sun comes up, that frost softens just a little bit.
Oh yeah.
And then they get like a little bit wet and it gets really quiet actually. Like you can't hear much. Mm-hmm. I remember it was about 8:15 and the sun was coming up kind of behind me. And I heard like just a crunch, crunch, like real soft, like right, like under me, almost behind me. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, that's probably a squirrel or whatever. I don't know, something. And then like, I hear another crunch. I'm like, that's a deer. And I'm like, oh, he's right behind me, or it's right behind me. I'm like, I don't know if I want to turn quick. You know, he's like, I don't know if he's looking at me, like the sun. And when I turned to look like in that direction, like out of the corner of my eye, like the sun was in my eyes. So I couldn't see anyway. So I'm like, I'm going to really have to like turn and like, you know, shade my eyes and look. And so I slowly, slowly did it, and I look over, and that deer is standing there at 20 yards looking the other way.
Holy smokes.
He's got damn near 14-inch G2s and like 20, I think it's like 25 or 6-inch beam. So in 20-something inches, he's a big frame deer. Just a really impressive buck. And I remember just looking at him like, oh, my God, look at that's him, and look at him. And at that point, I was wanting to shoot him with my bow, but it was muzzleloader season. So I had my bow and my muzzleloader with me. And he's standing there, you know, slightly quartering away at 20 yards. And I'm like, I can shoot him with my bow. So I grab my bow, clip on. I go to draw, and he just, like, turns directly away from me and starts walking away. And in that moment, I'm glad that I did this, but I was able to say, hang up your bow and pick up your muzzleloader, because you don't know when he's going to stop. He may, you know, not have a good shot, like whatever. So I didn't even miss a beat. I just like immediately turned back, hung up the bow, picked up my muzzleloader, and he ended up turning broadside at 40 and I shot him. And that was I was really excited about that one, because I feel like I kind of figured out that whole area and that deer within, you know, one season, which is tough to do, I think, a lot of times.
Right.
And, you know, predicted like that winter I'd kill a good deer. I didn't know what deer it was in that spot. And, you know, sure enough, it all came together. So that was an awesome one. He's just a really impressive, awesome buck too. Like one of my favorites that I've killed. So that one was special. I think the other one is an interesting one is one I tracked that I'll tell the story of, because that was a multi-year deal too. And that was a deer that I had chased him and another deer for a couple of years. And I had pictures of them, happened to be, I guess it was 5, 6, 7, and 8 is those years I had him. So like, I kind of loosely, I was in the area hunting another deer when he was 5, and like, he was a good deer then.
Yep.
And then when he was 6, I mean, I was definitely hunting him. 7. Yeah. And then when he was 8, I was like really focused on him. He was, when he was 7, he had his biggest frame.
Mm-hmm.
And he had he was never a big body deer. But he was heavy, like a heavy, massive deer.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty tight, but like tall tines, heavy tines. My buddy actually found sheds off him. He used to call them banana tines, to give you an idea of like what his tines look like.
Right.
And so I didn't really have a good idea. I had one basically spot where during the rut where I knew he cruised through, because I had him for three years doing it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all I really had on this deer. I knew he was around to get his picture here and there, early season velvet, like late, but it was like nothing. It was so random.
Mm-hmm.
But I really was like, okay, during the rut, I have a legitimate chance at this buck. And sure enough, when he was 8, he was there in the area doing like everything he should have. And so I planned to hunt him on, start hunting him. I was going to sit on him for like 10 days in the spot. And I planned to hunt, start on the 16th of November, because I'd had him like that 19th through I think 23rd period going through this spot in the past, and I wanted to be like on the early side of it in case he did it early.
Right.
Well, I got to stand the first morning, and I pulled the cart out of the camera I had on this main highway they take. You know, it's a big rut trail.
Mm-hmm.
And he had run through there at noon the day before.
Oof.
And I was like broad like daylight, sunshine, and like, oh, like, oh my God. Like I started a day late.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. I'm like, well, what are the chances he comes back through? I'm like, I don't know, if I put a week in, I think it may be decent. So I did, I put a week in there. I never saw him. But I got another picture of him, and he was at another camera in the area. He was within 100 yards of me 2 days later at like 11 in the morning. Just Oof. Never even saw him though. Yeah. So I was so close to killing him. And so, you know, that weekend I had him for like a week straight. Didn't saw some other bucks, but didn't see him. And so I was like, okay, well, I don't know what to do now, because I really don't have a late season play other than like, I have an idea of where he's at. And so this is, you know, fast forward. I had actually shifted some cameras into an area that I had gotten them in the past late season and actually had them, during the summer. And it seems like some of these deer go back to their summer areas late season.
Yeah,
depends on the situation.
Yeah. I've noticed that too.
Yeah. Have you? Yeah. I've seen it, and you know, it's not every situation, but you'll see that. And so, mm-hmm. and he was a buck that did that. And so I shifted some cameras into that area. I was like, well, maybe he'll show back up here. And it was probably a mile and a half from where I'd been hunting during the rut. Mm-hmm. And so I remember I checked those cameras on like December 4th or 5th, something like that. And I got him in daylight, and it was like maybe November 30th. And so he's back in there. I was like, well, that's good. Like, I think he's in there. That's a good sign. And it makes sense. Like, I predicted he'd be there. He's there. This is all kind of coming together. So, man, I'm like, maybe I have a chance at him late season. And so we got – it was – so that was, like, first few days of December. I don't know if I said November before. I meant December. Mm-hmm. So I checked that camera, got out of there, and I was like, well, I'm going to just spend time in there. I don't know how – I didn't really have stands there. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I'm like, I'll figure something out. And then on the 6th into the 7th of December, we got a big storm. I think we got like at least 15 inches, maybe like 18 inches of snow. Mm-hmm. And I just thought to myself, well, if he's in that late season spot and we just got all that snow, like he may be real tight in there. Like he may be right there. Like he,
right.
It might push him in. And it was, you know, it's a low lying area near a river. There's a lot of softwood down there. Like it's a pretty good winter or late season area, a lot of browse too. So I was like I think I might have an opportunity at him. Like if I can figure out how to hunt him in there, mm-hmm. we get the storm and I'm like, all right, like I'm going to go after him. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I knew I was going to be in there that morning after the fresh snow. And so we went in there and we actually filmed this, but,
yeah, it's a good video.
He walked by that same camera, like it, I don't know what time it was, probably an hour before light.
Yeah.
And I'm going in this area and it's on a log road. So I'm already going down this log road, mm-hmm. like kind of like accessing the area. And I see the track and I see the camera and I'm like, well, looks like a good buck track.
Right.
And sure enough, I checked the camera and it was him. And I was like, oh my God. I'm like, I have this deer's track. I'm like an hour or two behind him. We have fresh snow. He's, you know, I'm like, this could be really good. The part that surprised me is he wasn't doing the late season, you know, hangout bed browse type of thing. He was chasing does like an idiot. It's like, and it was like 10 degrees that I remember it was so cold, mm-hmm. you know, almost 2 feet of snow. And he's chasing does like to the point where it was hard to track them. It was like, I mean, it got into a ton of areas. It was like a barnyard because right. he was on two or three does and he did that like to two or three different doe groups throughout the day as we followed them. So I was almost kind of getting discouraged. I'm like, and it was difficult because it wasn't like it was 6 inches. I was having trouble getting through the snow too, you know, mm-hmm. like keeping up with them because it was that much snow. And I was like, man, this is getting challenging. But at about 2 o'clock, he left that lowland area and started climbing. And he got in another set or another group of does tracks and kind of just checked him out for a bit, followed him for maybe a couple hundred yards. Then he cut off and he went like straight up the mountain. Mm-hmm. And I was like, ooh, I'm like, this could be really good. And he got into this area of like real open timber. And I remember, and this is where he was like going straight up. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this may not be good because he's probably sitting up there looking down at me. That's kind of the feeling I had. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, and I was kind of sneaking up to the, you know, this pocket of open, trying to look up through it and trying to maybe see him. And I couldn't see him. And, you know, I couldn't really see his track very far. So anyway, I had no choice just to go up after him through that open spot. And I got to where the open spot turned. It was kind of one of those, you know, transitions I talk about. Mm-hmm. And it turned in some denser, you know, conifers. And there was a little bench there. And I just peeked up over the bench and I see a bed. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, he saw me. Like, it's all like, I, you know, it was like 2 o'clock at this point. So not that much daylight left. You got like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours to you know, chase him down at that point. So I was like, right. bummed. I'm like, damn, like I knew he'd be sitting up there looking down this big open mountainside at me. And so I was like, oh, what the heck? And so I looked in, it's like, it was his track. You know, I was pretty familiar with it at that point in the day. And it was definitely, you know, him. And I was like, oh shit. So I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the track and he like bounded out of his bed. And I had seen that initially and I'm like, well, let's just keep calling it, I guess, you know, whatever, we'll try to make up on him. And so I took like maybe went another 10 or 20 yards and then like he just started walking. Mm. And I was like, like, that's not, that doesn't make sense. Like, that he would have seen me and bounded 10 yards and just walked. Like, because, I mean, I had to have been within probably 150 yards of him when he saw me, right, down this mountainside. So I was like, I remember I looked, stopped, and Ross was filming. I looked at him. I'm like, he's right here. That's what I thought. I'm like, he is right here. Yeah. I'm like, and so, and there, that bench went up another, went up to another little bench. And so we just crept up that bench and got up on that level. And actually Ross saw him first, but I was kind of, he kind of like went out and side-hilled that bench, and then he doubled back, and he was just browsing. He's getting up and browsing, you know, for the afternoon. And he had doubled back, and he was kind of standing like right in front of us on the bench, but I was kind of looking out to like the right, if you will, like down along the ridge. And he was just standing there looking at us. And I don't know if he knew where it was. And he was kind of, there was some thick stuff before us or between us too. But yeah, I pulled up, shot him, and he went right down, and that was that. And that was a pretty awesome one, because it was a deer I'd been after for 4 years, and the whole season I'd hunted him. Right. And it was cool that it ended that way. Like, it just, you know, solidified for me too, that like, hey, you don't need to sit in the stand to kill these deer. You need to take your, you know, do whatever gives you the best odds to kill them if you want to be successful.
Right.
Whether that's tracking them, sitting in the stand, or, you know, whatever. So that was an awesome one. And he was a real challenge to get out to, because we were like dead at the end of that day.
Oh,
we didn't
cover
that much ground. Yeah, we didn't cover that much ground, maybe like 5 miles, something like that. But it was just like, it was so cold and the snow was so deep that we were just freaking beat. And we dragged that deer for maybe a half mile, like, and then we like gave up and we're like, we're gonna die. Like, we had no food, no water. We were like underdressed, and like, we had a long ways to go in. So we left him and got like the recovery, you know, party. And we actually have used a snowmobile to get into the area, like close to him. Because there's so much snow, and, you know, drag them out. And that was like, that was a special one for me too. And that was a right up there with one of the biggest antlered, like, scoring bucks that I've killed in the Northeast. But he was only like, he was probably like 150 pounds dressed,
really,
somewhere in there. I did weigh him, but I don't remember exactly what he was, but yeah, he was in that 150, 160 range, super run down. Like, you could see his spine and his ribs. And I don't know that he would have lived that winter, you know, cause he was in poor shape, you know? And then I kept thinking, like, why were you chasing those? And like, these extreme conditions, like, you're going to die, dude. You're an old man. And like, you know, he's 8.5 year old buck. And yeah, so it was cool. That was a really fun, you know, 4 year kind of journey after this deer. And it ended in a really cool way, and in a cool spot, like, you know, with super deep snow, cold, you know, up on a mountain. And yeah, it was a fun one.
Yeah.
So
what did
those
he
are
score?
Probably my top three. I think he grossed in the mid 150s, like one, I think 154 is sticking out in my mind. I'd score deer and whatnot, but I'd try not to get too technical on the stats, because I just feel like it takes away from
the story
of the deer. Because sometimes deer, like, don't have impressive stats. Like, they weren't that heavy, or they didn't score that high, but they're just so, you know, it's just an awesome animal. Honestly, the big thing that I love is the age. That's kind of what I'm after. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm after big, heavy, big antlered giant. I'm after the biggest and the heaviest and the biggest rack and the oldest, but I think out of the three, I'd take age probably.
Yeah.
You know, is my number one. And that to me is cool. So I like to hunt old ones. That's kind of my thing. And he other than he wasn't heavy, but he was old and, you know, had a big set of antlers. And he was, so he was a 10 point, a 5x5, had good brows, heavy mass, good twos, good threes, had like shorter fours. But the year before, he almost had no fours. He actually had broke one off, and then he had like one was like an inch. So he was basically a clean eight, and he was like about 150 inch clean, you know, if he without that little 1 inch G4 on the side, he's 150 inch eight.
Wow.
And so that was the year before, and because I actually have sheds. And then, you know, my buddy found a sheds, gave them to me from the year before that too, as well. So I have, you know, two sets of sheds with deer too, which kind of makes it even cooler. And both of those were, you know, guys gave them to me. So, that's special. And then, but he actually scored his best when he was eight, but his frame shrunk the reason he scored well is his G4s were like 5 inches and like 4 inches that year. So we just had more points, you know what I mean? But more, yeah. But he had actually kind of gone downhill on his frame and, you know, kind of on everything. Like his times were slightly shorter. He was a little bit narrower. He still had the mass, but yeah, just kind of shrunk. And it was interesting to see that like he had kind of peaked frame wise at 7, but then obviously scored just a tick higher at 8. But, and that's an interesting thing. I like to, it's cool to see how they change too through the years as they progress from like a young deer to an old deer. So if I can track one or, you know, keep track of one for 3, 4, 5 years, I really like that. It's super interesting to me to learn about them and see how they change, not only like their antlers, but like their patterns and, you know, mm-hmm. and all that. So, and their behavior, because I think I've seen behavior change too. And I think sometimes my theory is why some old deer leave an area is I think that they kind of are past their prime and they're not that 4 or 5 year old like maniac bully buck anymore, and they're kind of yep. more docile and like don't like an old man, right? Like I don't yep. fucking want to screw with you kids anymore, like I'm done. And yep. I think that another buck kind of moves up in their area and he's a big strong, you know, healthy 5 year old buck, and he just kind of like, I want to say he kicks him out, but he just doesn't want to deal with that anymore, so he kind of shifts. And I think that's kind of, that's my theory of what happens with these old bucks that kind of just disappear, and then you don't know if they got killed or not, or don't hear that they killed.
Right, yeah, they're not the dominant buck anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that deer yeah. in particular, he wasn't a huge body deer either, so I'm sure he was held his own, you know, when he was 5, 6 years old. But there's definitely, I know, a bigger, heavier deer in that area, you know, body wise, and a little bit younger too. So yeah, it was cool. You know, whenever I can follow one and learn about them, and then you know, put them on the wall, that's really kind of a special one to me. Mm-hmm.
All right, man. Well, thank you. I appreciate all the time that you've given me the past 2 days.
Absolutely. we got her done.
Yeah,
it was a challenge, but we got her done.
We got her done. Do you want to plug any of your socials or the YouTube channel or anything like that?
Yeah, if you guys want to check out, you know, a fair amount of what I talk to is, you know, documented on video, and it's on YouTube. So if you want to check out any of our content, you can go to Just Hunt Club on YouTube. That's the best place to find me. Yeah, I'm on Instagram too, but a lot of that stuff, the video stuff, the interesting stuff, I think is on the YouTube channel. And I've kind of throttled back on social media a little bit personally on my personal stuff. I just, I'm not as into it anymore. And I don't know. I think it's better for me.
Yeah, to be off it.
I am on there, but I just have been spending far less time and posting less. And, you know, if you want to know what's going on, definitely watch. Just go to the Just Hunt Club page and check it out. And it's not just obviously me on there. We have a team of guys, and most of our content is Northeast based, but there's stuff from all over the place as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I appreciate it. And we'll have to get you on again after this season. And
absolutely.
So you can talk about the big buck you shoot or the big bucks you shoot.
or the one I chased that got away. That happens too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope
it seems like every big one you shoot, there's 2 or 3 that get away, right?
Yeah, that's the way it is. So
it's like the behind the scenes things. If we killed every big one we're after, it'd be pretty wild. So not right. many guys doing that.
Nope. Yeah, it wouldn't be hunting then. It'd just be killing.
No. Right.
All right, boys.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I'll get you guys on the next one.